Hey everybody, welcome back to another podcast, Hints and Guesses. And I received a little feedback about my last podcast, which was largely about the Jacob story and what I was calling mythopoetic reading. And people want to know what that is, what I meant by that. And I tried to explain it a bit. So I thought I'd try to take that on. And I guess today would truly be, in the spirit of T.S. Eliot, a hint and a guess, because I keep hovering around this idea, this notion, mythopoetic, and what that means. And so in a way, I'm also searching for a definition and for the depth of such a notion or an idea. And I'm not saying I'll get to the bottom of it, but I want to provide at least a little background. How did I get here? And why do I think it matters? Not only in terms of how we might read the Bible or other stories or other sacred texts, but how it might influence the way we see the world. And I guess I also mean the way we see ourselves. And I guess in light of that, I was thinking about a line from Jesus, and this is what he says: "But when your eye is bad, your whole body is filled with darkness," which I guess is another way of saying, when you can't see well, or how you see affects your internal awareness or your internal way of viewing things. So if your eye is not working, if you can't see properly, you can't see properly. And in a way, it affects your inner state. And then he goes on and says, "And if the light you think you have is actually darkness, how deep is that darkness?" In other words, having a bad eye, so to speak, and yet calling that bad eye, that way of seeing, light, it's even darker. Your inner state is even darker. Maybe what Jesus is saying is that, all right, it's one thing to have a bad eye that affects the way you see the world and your own inner state, but it's quite another thing to call that bad eye good. To call the way you see things light. How deep then is that inner darkness if your bad eye you're calling a good eye, you're calling light? Think about that just in terms of the state of politics right now, where so many people are claiming on either side, I suppose, the way we see it is the right way to see it, is the good way to see it. In other words, we see with an eye full of light. And I suppose the way to detect this kind of bad eye that's claiming to be light is when the way you see things causes so much pain and suffering and heartache and rejection and categorizing and labeling and demonizing and scapegoating some other party, some other person, some other human being, some way of dismissing them, all the while claiming to see quite clearly. It's like what Jesus said about the Pharisees: if you claim to see, you are already blind, which I think should sort of level all of us, including me, claiming to see clearly. So here I am about to give a podcast about seeing, and I wanted to start there, because how we see anything, how we see the text, how we see the stories of the text, how we see theology, how we see nature, how we see relationships and human beings and the government and economics matters a great deal. Much of spirituality, it's been said, is about cleaning out the eyes or the lens, both in a sense so that what is innately good down in there can come out So pass through the eye going out, and also what is actually true about the world, being able to see that more clearly and penetrating one's own heart or soul. At least that's my take on spirituality as sight. So what I'd like to do is just admit right from the beginning that I'm hoping my own way of seeing, my own eye, will be cleaned, and my own way of seeing things, reading the text, reading relationships, reading reality with a capital R, will be changed. And who wants a bad eye in the end? One wants a good eye, or a better eye, or a cleaner eye. As Jesus says elsewhere, take the plank, the board, the massive beam out of your own eye, then you can see clearly. So that's what I'm hoping. And as part of that, as part of at least how I understand the cleaning of my own lens, which has happened very slowly, I want to pass on to you some things that have influenced me. And all in an effort, I think, to reimagine our relationship with the great stories, with the great stories that have shaped us consciously and unconsciously, with the great stories that have the power, the capacity to continue to shape us, to open up pathways of meaning and depth. Who wants to skim along the surface of life? I don't. Or as Mary Oliver says, I don't want to have only visited this world. That's the way I feel. And I think that that's related to the way we read the great stories, like the great stories of the Bible, which, you know, some might say, hey, just get over it. But we can't get over it. We can't get over it because so much of the biblical narrative shapes contemporary culture, contemporary Western culture, particularly American culture. And so if that's the case, I think we definitely need a cleaning of the lens. So let's start with mythopoetic, which I've tried to define in the last episode. Mythos, of course, means story in its more direct form. And where do these notions come from? They really, as best we can tell, and I'm not an expert in this particular field, so I'm sure someone can write me and correct me and give me a little more insight, but a lot of this, the freshness of a word like mythopoetic is rooted in Carl Jung, who became a master of archetypes, and an archetypal way of reading human nature, an archetypal way of reading the unconscious, and also reading the stories and myths, the great stories and myths. And what's an archetype? An archetype is a pattern. And according to Jung, that pattern is mostly unconscious and probably has no bottom. In other words, we don't come into the world as a tabula rasa, as a blank slate. We actually come into the world, our psyches come into the world having been shaped by previous psyches, in the same way our physical characteristics are shaped by our genes, by our predecessors, by our ancestors, by our parents and grandparents. Well, the same, the theory goes, is true of our own psyches. And our psyches, in a way, are much older and contain patterns that are much, much older than just our lived experience. And this was a revolution. And I think in some ways, we're still coming to terms with this kind of revolution of thought. This is why, by the way, very, very young children can have very ancient dreams, the images in their dreams, having no exposure to ancient religions or images or rituals. Sometimes very young children will dream these things. Where do those come from? Well, the idea is that they're built into the system in some way, that they're mostly unconscious and they come out in the form of an image, hence an archetype. So if all this sounds like a little too much, let's just take a really simple one. Let's say you have a dream, and in your dream, you see an old man, kind of in ragged clothes with a cane and maybe a small bag of some sort. And you have the intense feeling that this person is a wanderer. Now, how would you know that? What is the feeling sense of that? Well, you just know that in the dream. Here's a wanderer. And it turns out that the wanderer is also an archetype. And how is it appearing in this particular dream? It's appearing as an old man with a, you know, some ragged clothes and a staff walking and wandering over the earth. And so when we encounter such images in stories, it unlocks something. The archetype hints at a pattern that unlocks something that's much deeper, and that is this sort of unconscious pattern of wandering. So even Abram, or Abraham as he later came to be called, was called, there's a line in the Bible that says, my father, meaning Abram or Abraham, was a wandering Aramean. Now, just saying that phrase, Abraham is a wanderer or was a wanderer, taps into this, the deep structure of this particular pattern, this particular archetype. In other words, we come from a lineage of wanderers. We know what that's like on the psychic level. We know what that's like on the physical level. And the greatest stories on earth have these archetypal patterns, which is why they're so powerful, which is why they connect, why they hook us, why we are suddenly drawn in, which is why the biblical stories lasted, why they started telling stories of this wandering Aramean and who later became the father of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people, the entire ethnic makeup of the Jewish people has seeds of wanderers. Even some of the most famous contemporary sculptures, which I've seen in the Israel Museum, for example, you have this wandering Jewish archetype, which goes all the way back to Abraham, and I would suggest is much older than Abraham, period, because the archetype is as old as the human story. So that's kind of what I mean about archetypes, and a mythopoetic reading begins to become aware of these things, begins to sink into these things, begins to explore beneath the surface what these images call forth, and we also allow these archetypal patterns to begin to shape us. In what ways are we like this? Or what gets unlocked or opened when we begin to allow these stories to wash over us in this way? And I mean, even in a very simple sense, the world right now is such a mess, such a crazy, convoluted mess, where saying, what if there was a family, a man, a woman, who set off for a country they hadn't ever seen before? And maybe they were thought by all parties, their parents, their culture, their society, their country, their flag. They thought, these people are crazy, setting off for a world that they've never seen before. See, that's the kind of archetypal energy that can come through a story when we read this way, more mythopoetically, that can activate something in us. Because believe me, we need people who are setting off for a country they have not seen and are willing to suffer the solitude of wandering, the solitude, the ridicule, the sense of homelessness, going without food for a time, just like Abram and Sarah went through as they began to set off for some unknown country. Anyway, so how do we get close to a more archetypal, mythopoetic reading? So here are a couple things I want to mention. And it actually has to do with epistemology, how we come to know anything at all. So I want to give you really three things to think about. The first comes from Bill Plotkin, who is one of my teachers. Bill Plotkin in a book called Wild Mind, and probably elsewhere too, highlights something that he calls the four windows of knowing. And I'll just give them to you briefly. The windows of knowing are thinking, feeling, sensing, and imagination. And what he says is that all human beings have the capacity to come to know something using all four windows of knowing. And what's happening, you know, I guess in the Western world largely, is that we're dominated by one particular way of coming to know, and that is thinking. That's why we send kids to school, go and learn to think. Although, if you ask any philosophy student, or actually a friend of mine is a philosophy professor at ASU, and he says most kids who come into his class have not really been taught how to think. So maybe thinking in its most simple form is our primary way of coming to know. But all these other windows, like feeling, is a way of coming to know the world. Sensing, our five senses, and maybe we could include in there also intuition. This, a place or a person can have a certain sense about them. And imagination, something any four-year-old, five-year-old has absolutely no problem with, but it sort of gets crushed in us, stamped out, dismissed, unless you become, quote, an artist, then that's sort of allowed, but of course that's not all that practical. So why am I saying that? Because I think if we're ever going to walk toward a more mythopoetic reading of the Bible, and even walk toward our unlocking our own depth on the archetypal, metaphoric, symbolic level, where we're allowing stories to activate something that needs to be brought forth in the world, which is the point of all this. How do we bring forth the best of who we are in the world to change the world, or to be a participant in a more generative world would be a better way of saying it, I think. Then we have to activate our four-faceted epistemological capacities. I know that sounded fancy, or it did to me, I guess. Thinking, feeling, sensing, and imagination. And you actually know that if you've ever fallen in love. Because that's the sort of creepy thing about all these dating websites, because you're simply filling out categories. And I haven't done it personally, so I'm sure there are lots of emotional categories and things like that. But it's kind of an algorithm for matching up using, I think, the thinking mind. This is a guess on my part, saying this must be like this, must be like this. And if you can do the math in this relationship, then it's going to work out. But there are three other ways of coming to know someone, and three other avenues. And that is the feeling sense. It might all work on a piece of paper, and you just might not have this a feeling that a feeling of love, or even of attraction, or allurement, or your senses. I mean, what the research is showing about attraction and smell is kind of fascinating. It can all work on a piece of paper, and unconsciously, the smell of another human being might not work for you. So this is a way of coming to know something. And of course, the imagination. And anyone who's ever fallen in love and suddenly thought they were a poet knows the power of an active imagination. And that's a good thing. And I think my experience in evangelical Christianity, when it comes to reading the Bible, these other ways of knowing are almost entirely excluded. Or maybe they'll given credence for a moment. Oh, you feel this way, but then you're told how you should feel. And the senses, I mean, even if a strong image in the Bible activates some senses, we're quickly told, well, this is what it means. So quickly, the Bible is not allowed to be a story, because we're told the point of the story is that it means something. And imagination, forget about it, because imagination might lead us out beyond the confines of orthodoxy and out beyond the acceptable edges of the, quote, correct reading. So in other words, to get close to the mythopoetic, you need these four winds of knowing. Michael Mead, the mythologist, has a kind of threefold way of speaking about this, and he calls it three kinds of thinking. And maybe if I would ever have a conversation with him, we could talk about, do you mean thinking or do you mean knowing? But it doesn't matter. He calls it three kinds of thinking: the rational, or the logic, logos in Greek, absolutely essential, our primary Western way of thinking. But then he says there's a kind of psychological thinking where there's more nuance and more depth. And actually, psychology has the word soul in it. So you're starting to get a more soul-oriented way of thinking at this point. Or what William James, he called psychology the science of the mental life. And you're bringing in psychological insights, conscious and unconscious. You're beginning to talk about patterns of thought when you're beginning to think about the world psychologically, if that makes sense. And then he says the third level enters when the first two fail, or fail would maybe be the wrong way of putting, when you reach the limit, because rational thought has a limit. And even the psychological has a limit. And he says that's when the mythological enters. So the three ways of thinking are rational, psychological, and mythological. And in the old stories, this would be when the trickster enters. The moment when the functioning kingdom and all of the wise people can't accomplish something, and then the mythological enters. This you have in the Joseph story, where the Pharaoh has these dramatic dreams and nobody can figure them out. And up from the dungeon comes a dreamer who begins to speak mythologically into the kingdom itself, which then opens up the king's eyes so he can see his own dream. And it becomes not even personal at that point, but can see the pathway of the kingdom, that we're going to experience a few years of abundance, and then we're going to experience a few years of famine. That's a kind of king whose lens has been cleansed for a moment and cleaned for a moment through the mythological, through the dreamer of Joseph, who comes up out of the dungeon and surprises the rational and the psychological and the way things ordinarily work. So you have these two, I think, helpful pathways that can begin to unlock the mythological. The last comes from Walter Brueggemann, who's really trying to make a comment about the Bible and the development of human consciousness. And maybe you've heard this before, but he says something along the lines that the Bible reflects the evolution, I don't know if he uses that word, that's the word I would use, the evolution of human consciousness, the development of human consciousness. And I think you could even add the development of theological awareness or theological consciousness. And you see that in the literature of the Bible itself. That's one of the things that makes particularly the Hebrew Bible so profound, that it tends to hold all what he says are three levels. I don't really like levels, but let's just go with them. Three levels of consciousness. So what are they? Torah, prophets, and wisdom. That the absolute genius of the Bible is that it contains all three. And they actually correspond quite nicely to Michael Mead's rational, psychological, and mythological, or even, I think, to Plotkin's thinking, feeling, sensing, and imagination in this respect. Torah is much more rational. It's much more thinking-oriented. What are the rules? What should I do? What should I not do? What should I eat? What should I not eat? How do I set up an altar? How do I go to a place of worship? What are the seasons and cycles, and how am I supposed to observe the seasons and cycles in the right way? And actually, much more practical than even that, how to be a good citizen, how to be a good Hebrew back in the day. What are the ordinary laws for a civil society? That's the level of Torah. It's where we all start. It's the thinking mind. It's the rational, logic mind. And you know when a rule has been broken, you know when a rule has been kept. Except we all know that that's a very limited view of the world, that sometimes the rules can be broken. Like the Dalai Lama saying, learn the rules well so you will know how to break them properly. He's, in his own trickster way, is pushing us to the limits of this first and important aspect of being human, this thinking, rational, logical, Torah-oriented mind. Now, the prophets represent the next layer. Maybe this is like a swirl going down to the bottom of a well, maybe a bottomless well at that. So the prophets come in and say, yeah, well, it does say keep the Sabbath. I realize that. It does say keep the new moon festivals. That's in the Torah, except Isaiah says your Sabbaths and your new moon festivals are detestable to God. Or Jeremiah says, oh, you come in and you're like, oh, the temple, the temple, the temple. Who cares about the temple when you turn around and shed the blood of the innocent? So this is the conscious, a kind of deeper conscience is what I meant. This is a deeper conscience coming up out of the scriptures, out of the development of consciousness, you could say, coming up out of the Bible, this prophetic voice. And it's much more psychological. It's much more nuanced, to use Michael Mead's Three Ways of Knowing. It's actually involving beyond just thinking, but feeling and sensing. Feeling the pain of oppressed people. And who particularly, according to the prophets, the widows, the orphans, the aliens, and the foreigners. This awakening of, wait a minute, it's not just about me, it's not just about power, it's not just about keeping the rules, it's not just about those on top, but society itself and the good life itself, which I think the Bible is sort of asking in a larger sense, what is the good life, has to involve the underside of society. And if the underbelly of society is suffering, then there's no point in keeping the Torah. Or the Torah becomes a kind of offense to God. Like, go ahead and keep the Sabbath. It's sort of like if a prophet were to rise up today and say, you think just because you go to church and give 10% and yet you turn around and your actions, consciously or unconsciously, affect negatively those in the bottom of society, then this religion is a joke. That's the prophetic awareness beginning to come to light. Now, that's not it. You think that's enough. That's, or enough might be the wrong way. You think, wow, what a revolution in thought, but that's, we're just getting warmed up. Brueggemann says if you continue down the well, we're spinning slowly down into the depths here, you stumble upon wisdom literature. And the wisdom literature of the Bible is the most mysterious. Contains the most depth. It's the book of Ecclesiastes talking about the meaninglessness of life. And there's really no cleaning it up. It's the book of Job wondering about the point of suffering. And the book of Job does not end with any answers, period. It simply turns over the mystery of life, the mystery of human being, of being a human being, the mystery of suffering, and also the mystery of existence. It's Isaiah looking up and saying, I look up at the stars and I think, who created all these? And then doesn't supply an answer like, oh, that's easy, that's God. No, but rather revels in the mystery. And there are plenty of really rich, mystical, mysterious texts and stories in the Bible. And once you're down on that level, you're into the mythological, you're into the archetypal, you're into the symbolic, you're into the unconscious, you're into the imagination, to use Plotkin's language. So I think these grids, or rubrics, or I don't know, you don't have to use anything fancy, just these systems, I think, have something in common. That if we back up and say, how do we see? One of the things we have to admit is that the initial way of seeing things, the thinking mind, the rational logic, Torah, has its gifts, but also has its limitations. And if we're only stuck there, we never descend into the depths of the well. We never get beyond that first layer. We never touch upon the prophets. We never touch upon beneath that the mystery. We never sink into the psychological or the mythological. And we resist our feeling and our senses beginning to be to take shape, and ultimately our imagination. And I think, greater than that, the soul, are the seeds of who we are, and what we're to bring forth in the world, get blocked. So the question, I think, becomes, how do we begin to clean the lens? And this is no one-time fix. I think it's something that we cultivate. We turn over like the soil, season after season. It's not about becoming some sort of expert in this, but I think about, if it's just in terms of cultivation, beginning to turn some attention to other windows of knowing, to begin to turn attention to other kinds of thinking, to begin to turn our attention beneath our initial impulses about story, and allow, almost like Alice in Wonderland, start to go down the rabbit hole. And when that begins to happen, I think a certain amount of our grip needs to loosen. And, you know, some of this, by the way, exists right inside the mystical Christian tradition. If you take the cloud of unknowing, for example, this classic mystical text by an unknown author, which is awesome. I mean, it's like such a challenge to people like me who have written books. I mean, would you write a book and not put your name on it, you know? I mean, this is already someone who's operating on a different level. He's not trying to, quote, get published or get on some bestseller list. He's simply saying, how can I help the people, the nuns who he is working with, he's their superior. So he's simply saying, here's the best advice I can give you. Anyway, so in the cloud of unknowing, he says the first step into a deeper reading of one's own life, we could say, of what is prayer, he's talking a bit about, and this applies to the reading of the text or theology, one's relationship with God or with other people, spirituality in general. I'm broadening all this out. He says the first step is to enter the cloud of forgetfulness, which, if you take back to our initial stages, the thinking mind or the rational logic and the Torah, some measure of forgetfulness is needed to sink beneath the surface. You say, yes, but maybe that's not it. In fact, I may even need to forget for a moment to sink beneath. So it says, keep the Sabbath, forget about it. What's beneath that? And that's the challenge of it. And that's why some loyal part of us says, don't do this. Don't go any further. It's going to be dangerous. God's not going to like you, or your parents aren't going to like you, or you're going to be kicked out of your church or your community. And all of that might be true, actually. So I suppose that voice is trying to do us a favor. So as a way of just a brief example, let's talk about the Abraham story. So the opening line is this. God says to Abram, leave. Go. Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to a land I will show you. Not go to the land that we talked about previously, or here's a map and it's called X. just you will be shown, which already, you know, you're dabbling, I'm jumping ahead, into the wanderer archetype, because he doesn't know where he's going. But think about this sort of three, these levels of reading this particular text. On the initial thinking level, what is this text about? Well, you could say, oh, it's about God telling Abram something and him doing it. So we ought to be obedient like Abram. And whenever God says, go, we're going to go. And on one level, I suppose that's straightforward. That's true enough. That's the rational thinking Torah approach to reading this story. God says, Abram does, that makes him a pretty good person, and away the story goes. But if we're to activate other windows of knowing or kinds of thinking, we have to begin to ask different kinds of questions. So if we're reading on the more psychological level, we might ask something like, what does it mean to leave one's country? What does it mean to leave one's people? I mean, these are major identity markers. This is actually, on the psychological level, how we come to know who we are. We come to know who we are by our people, by our country, our flag. And what does it mean to leave father's household? Every single identity marker in my life on a psychological level is being pushed against. And Abram goes, but without knowing where he's going. What would that feel like, we might say, to be Abram? And that's what's so curious about a lot of biblical texts. We don't get a lot of feeling. It sort of leaves the feeling sense of the story to the imagination, which now we're sinking even further into the depths of the story. But what would it feel like to be Abram? And what does that ask of someone? And what might it be saying culturally? If things are going to change, and if there's going to be a story, if there's going to be a quote of Jewish people, which are yet to come in the story, why does it require a kind of leaving home? What does that say on the psychological level? What does that say? I mean, if you go back to Brueggemann, Torah, straight ahead rules, but on the level of prophets, there's a kind of no here. There's a no, I'm not going to go the way of ordinary identity, which is about country and flag and people group and ethnicity, but I'm going to be a wanderer on this earth and wandering toward the unknown. These are really, really rich themes, which I think takes us even closer to the mythological level, the mythopoetic dimensions of the story. And here's where we begin to see Abram, not just as a historical figure, a guy back then, and not even just as a kind of psychological stand-in for what it's like when we get to places like this in our culture, where there's a certain kind of leaving, but a kind of archetype that might be awakening within. And in other words, is there an Abram figure in the depths of our very soul that is hearing a call, hearing a mysterious voice that's leading us out into the unknown? Now we're dealing on the more mythic level, on the archetypal level. And what would it look like? What is this voice exactly saying? And I'm not saying the voice is saying exactly what was said to Abraham, but it awakens in the imagination realm, in the mythic realm, this question: to what am I called? Is my life just about keeping the rules? Is my life about my social identity, my country, my ethnicity, my skin color, my father, my dad, even my story, my parents, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, that Shakespeare, the life I was born into, what the Greeks call fate, the certain limits that we find ourselves in, is that really my life? Or am I edging ever closer towards St. Francis's deep and profound question of who am I? Who am I beneath all that stuff? And once you're down on that level, you're tapping into the mythic, the archetypal. And that has the power to put pressure on the ego, your egoic persona, who you think you are. You're a religious person, you're a good boy, you're a bad boy, you're a rebel, you're a dad, you're a mom, you're born into this zip code, you went to this particular school, you think about yourself at a certain political party, even all the psychological stuff that people throw around, like I'm an Enneagram this, or I'm a Myers-Briggs this, and whatever, all the personality tests. What is beneath all that? And the archetypal layer in the story is trying, at least in my view, to tap into that question. Who am I? And is there a voice that's whispering to me in the very depths of my being and calling me out to be someone, to bring forth that someone into the world? That's maybe what the Greeks also called genius. The genius, the seed, the light, the lamp that's already in the depths of this, of the soul, that has to be recovered and has to be whispered to and brought forth into the world. Then we're dealing with, I think, the richest layer of these particular stories. So that's my best hint and guess for the time being around some of these mythopoetic themes and questions. And this is part one. I'm going to do part two, which has, I think, more to do with stages. And I'll talk about some of my influences around stages in the next particular podcast. Let me end with this quotation from Jesus: "But when your eye is bad, your whole body is filled with darkness." When your eye is bad, your whole body is filled with darkness. And if that light you think you have is actually darkness, how deep is that darkness?